The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Hello, Zero Books listeners, viewers, and readers. The podcast you're about to hear features Ankur Dhyanmote and I discussing the need for a paradigm shift in a time of COVID-19, riots, dogs and cats living together, and so on. It's Friday, July 10th, 2020, and I'm Douglas Lane, the host of this podcast and the publisher of Zero Books, or the publishing manager of Zero Books. If you enjoy this podcast, support us on Patreon, please. The more support we get on Patreon, the more we can do. We're thinking about making a film, or at least a feature-length video for Ben Burgess's upcoming book, Canceling Comedians, which is about the need for strategy on the left. You'll also get access to three podcasts a week. If you support us on Patreon, that is, you'll get access to every episode of Zero Squared. You'll get access to Pop the Left every week. And you'll also get access to either TV and Theory and or Cinema and Communism. Those are two podcasts I'm doing with my son and daughter. And we're reading Rosa Luxemburg's Reform and Revolution and Jill Dovey's From Crisis to Communization. Tune in for that. Pay $5 a month for that. It's worth it. And you're supporting our digital content, including a new project with Ben Burgess. The music you're listening to right now is Funky Town by Lips Incorporated. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Ankur and I discuss that need for a paradigm shift. Since the last time we spoke, I guess the major thing that's changed is that there's been there was an uprising in the United States.
Right.
And since the uprising, there's been a massive protest all around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And our topic today is to talk about paradigm shifts.
Yeah, I think that's where we kind of left off last time. And it seems like it's a fitting theme to talk about right now.
I think so. Well, why don't you tell me what your definition of a paradigm shift is, and then we can see how it applies.
So I was thinking of looking at paradigm shifts through examples. So that if we agree on a few examples, maybe that will help us to formulate our common definition of paradigm shifts. So if I have to think about paradigm shifts in our understanding of general reality, then the Copernican Revolution is an example of a paradigm shift, or the idea that life evolves through the slow spatiotemporal process over billions of years, that realization was kind of a paradigm shift. The discovery of the DNA code is a paradigm shift. And I guess in other senses, I suppose something that we've talked about before, like developing language, printing, these could be paradigm shifts. The Industrial Revolution is a paradigm shift. The internet is a paradigm shift. So these are essentially changes taking place in in some specific domain of human activity that results in a shift in how our perception of reality is perceived, or basically shifts a model of reality.
The difference between a scientific discovery and a paradigm shift has to do with whether or not the discovery makes the original frame or model for a given aspect of reality no longer function.
It could be no longer functional, or it could be a major revision on that. I believe that most of these paradigm shifts are they emerge because of previous paradigms in some ways. Like the previous paradigm creates the precondition for a new paradigm.
But like, at least in the example that comes to mind first and foremost for me, which is the paradigm shift from a humor based understanding of biology. Basically, I don't know it too well, but it focused on the kinds of fluids that there were,
right,
in the body, from that to the germ theory, uh-huh, of disease,
uh-huh,
changed, made the humor model no longer relevant, or just didn't seem to have any bearing on reality any longer after you understood the germ theory of disease.
Yes, fair enough. That's a good example, yeah.
And I would say that so are there other examples which do the same thing in terms of negating the previous model? I mean, give me an example again from the list that you just gave me, like I guess from hunter and gathering societies to agriculture would be another one that would be a category or a paradigm shift.
Right. Or the Industrial Revolution would be one.
The Industrial Revolution, right. From feudalism.
Right.
Paradigm shift. And so I don't know if I don't think that you can have the Industrial Revolution take hold and not have it where it takes hold, not eliminate feudalism. I mean, negate the effectiveness and the ethical justification and the modeling of the world that would justify feudalism. It seems to be gone after you bring in capitalism and the Industrial Revolution.
Right. So that's an interesting point, because I have been thinking about it. Is it like it disappears, or it mutates into something else that remains still influential? In a way, like, for example, does feudalism affect our mindset in a way that, in spite of the Industrial Revolution, we are still processing reality through some kind of a blind spot that feudalism has left in our perspective?
Well, this is an interesting question, because unlike in the sciences, where you know that you're changing a model.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, no. Maybe it's more similar than I think. But because, you know, the idea behind feudalism and authority in under feudalism had something to do with the divine right of kings, right?
Uh-huh.
Something to do with authority manifested on earth that represented a celestial authority.
Uh-huh.
Some sort of – so it was beyond just a natural authority. It was, you know, a divine authority.
Right.
The Tsar in Russia, Nicholas II, he wanted to hold on to – he felt it was his duty to hold on to power, because it was, you know, his religious duty. It was his divine right, but not, you know, even if it felt to him like a burden.
Right. It's also inherited, right? I mean –
it's inherited.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. I mean, I think it's inherited, although, you know, there are different – families that take power too, so, and become kings. There's different dynasties. I wonder what the Romanov family in Russia, I wonder what the previous dynasty was, and what family, if any, if the Tsar even existed as a category before the Romanov family. I would bet it did.
In a different form, maybe, but I don't know.
I'll, you know what? This is one of those things that the internet's useful for.
Yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and, since we're just recording audio, I'll look it up.
Cool.
Romanov family. The Romanov family, the House of Romanov was the reigning royal house of Russia from 1613 to 1917.
Okay.
They became, okay, so the family before that was the Rurik dynasty. It was just, which ran for, you know, several hundred years as well. So the actually from like, for like off and on for 800 years.
Huh.
So anyhow, I don't know Russian history that well. But I do know that if you look to, you know, the UK or to the story of the English royal family, you'll see that, it's not just one family.
Uh-huh.
Although it seems like it, because, you know, families last a long time.
Right. They create an, they all, I think, feed off each other, or they're interrelated. Like it's a power dynamic that, once established, I think generates more and more in favor of perpetuating that structure. So if there were feudal families, interconnected to each other, dynasties interconnected to each other, they propagate the system that allow dynasty or the concept of dynasty to perpetuate through time. So it seems like it's inherited in certain branches of it, but the overall thing is also stacked up by some model, like what you mentioned earlier, like some divine you know, divine force has basically given this duty to the people to be in charge.
The autocratic rule through heredity gave way, but then you're wondering if something remained that from the old system that remains in the present one. And you know, Marx would say that every society, the history of all of history, is a history of class struggle. So, but on the other hand, it's only after you get the bourgeois revolutions and the industrial revolution that you can see class struggle as a defining aspect of society. That what was a caste system in the past has become a class struggle in the present because of the change that's been underway. So it's only basically once you made the change that you can look back on the past and still see your model was having influence in the past. It wasn't something that people would have thought of under feudalism, that they lived in a class society, especially if they wouldn't have divided it up between those who worked and those who didn't, the same way we do now. So I would say that's like a retroactive understanding of a common thread. Like you can't, until the change hasn't been made, you can't find the commonality. Well, another quote was like, the way to understand the ape is through man. Marx said that. So that you can't, yeah. Again, you can't find the truth about the ape until you understand humanity, until you find the next step up in the evolutionary chain. The commonality between ape and man will certainly be lost.
That's interesting for me. Why I thought it was interesting is that because this whole business of understanding is a very human indulgence. It's a human concern. And so you can actually not understand anything without understanding human beings, is what I feel. I mean, whether it's apes or trees or anything, it's this whole business of understanding is a very human activity.
That's true, but I think he was trying to say something more specific than that. He was actually, because it didn't choose the ape at random, right? Like he was saying, you know, just like you can't understand let's say, in the arts, let's say you can't understand abstract expressionism except through the lens of postmodernism. It would be a similar kind of, you know, whatever came after. So it's like, yeah, the model that we're in is what allows us to understand the model that we were in is sort of the idea there. Well, I have this thing in the back of my mind that I want to bring forward, but I guess this might be a good enough time. So the looting was going on, and the riots were going on a few weeks ago now, and at the time, that's what really dominated the news, was the fact that there were massive people out protesting, but those protests and the riots were kind of indistinguishable from each other. Not everyone was rioting, but the riots provided a context within which – I mean, the protests provided a context within which the riots could operate and the looting could operate. And it was very large. I mean, it's like 500 cities were approaching that. It was every state. It was a huge reaction to the murder of George Floyd, much larger than I anticipated. When the riots first broke out in Minnesota, I posted on Facebook something like, hey, come on, everybody, let's not get ahead of ourselves. This isn't a revolution. And two days later, Trump is hiding in the bunker at the White House. And I'm going, well, maybe I was wrong. I didn't really think that it was a revolution even then, but it was certainly much, much bigger than I had thought. And so the question now is what actually did happen, I think, with the riots and the looting and the quasi uprising or the attempt at an uprising. What was going on there? And then in the context of that, what's happening now? But one thing that you can say about looting is that while it seems as though it's a move to overthrow the legal system and the economic system of the present in favor of an immediate seeking after one's needs. And, you know, that's what makes it illegal in a way, is the immediacy of it. It's the way it overturns property relations and other ethical concerns to immediately grab hold of what these people need, that because they've been denied what they need. They've been suppressed. They've been made subaltern. They've been oppressed. So the strange thing about it is if you look at the things that they would grab, not all of them are the same, but let's say they, you know, big screen TVs is an example of the kinds of things that people would loot. Anytime you loot something like a big screen TV, you are foreclosing the possibility of a paradigm shift. Because you're assuming that the society you're in is going to continue on as it has. In other words, there'll be electricity. Not only that, there will be programming, you know, all the things that go on in the background to make that TV function and worthwhile. Because in and of itself as an object, it's not worth anything. It's only worth something in the context of a functioning society. So, and, you know, sector. So when you grab a big screen TV, when you're looting, you are, without meaning to, admitting that you have no plans to fully negate the society you're in. You plan on it continuing.
I think that's a valid interpretation, but you could also say that we're assuming that the looting is part of the revolution, or it's part of that movement. It is also been pointed out that the looting is an opportunistic reaction by some people, or it has been machinated by other people with vested interests in the entire situation. So, what you're saying completely is still valid. I think it's still valid. And I'm just like maybe trying to be a little more inclusive of other possibilities over here. But
right. Well, if we take the looting out if we say, okay, the looting doesn't count as part of the uprising, then all we have left is the property damage, the things like the burning of the police precincts and the city halls. But if I think that without the looting and the massive protests, that the concentrated efforts to go after police precincts would have been less successful. That the police, if they had only had to take care of and manage defending their own precincts or government buildings, and if that's all that was happening, then there wouldn't have been the opportunity to actually circumvent their power and take those places on.
Right. So it adds a more it makes it more challenging for the authorities to deal with. Is that what
you're
suggesting?
Yeah, yeah. And also, you're talking about removing a whole bunch of people from the picture. Obviously the main engine of all of this was the thousands and thousands of people who were out protesting. The degree to which those protests were always including acts of vandalism and property destruction at the start, and whether or not they were often just peaceful protests of marching with signs and things like that, something I'm not exactly sure about. And when you talk about the first 3 or 4 days, I don't know to what extent. If there's no one who's, I've never seen any numbers or analysis of just how that broke down. But my feeling at the time was that there was massive people out there protesting peacefully. There was a lot of people out there doing property damage. There were some people out there who were strategic in the way that they attacked, say, City Hall here in Portland or the police precinct in Minneapolis or wherever else, in Seattle. And then there were people who are opportunistically looting at the same time. But I don't think you can clearly I just happen to know from my own spies who were out there early days that the people who would go out to politically protest would become looters. And so the same people could go through a peaceful march into a more confrontational situation with the cops and then end up being pushed off to the side or somewhere where they were looting.
That's definitely, I think that's reasonable, given the vulnerability of crowd mentality. So when we start looking at crowds, we start looking at behavior that is very unpredictable. In one way, it's unpredictable. In some ways, it's quite predictable. So I wonder if people who know this, I mean, if you want to go in the conspiracy theory mode for a moment, I wonder if people who want to take advantage of this to rouse the situation to make it ineffective or counterproductive might probably plant some triggers that would make people lose it. And when you have that sort of a thing happening in a herd, in a crowd, we're probably going to see something like this as a reaction, like a knee-jerk reaction.
Well, I don't think that the police or the reaction from the authorities, which might include the National Guard, was such that they wanted to encourage looting or even property damage or violence. But I do think that what happened was that instead is that there was an urge out there already in response to the looting that happened originally in Minnesota to want to emulate that because it was seemed as a justified act of destruction as much as it was as an opportunistic act of stealing. So like, and there wasn't, I do think there was overall was a desire to attack authority in the United States. That, you know, to negate it, to get rid of it, to go beyond the authority that, that existed. But although I don't know if that last thing is quite true, but, you know, if it, in that sense, we're talking about an uprising as an attempt to do a pair, to create a paradigm shift.
Right. But is, so I wonder, like when we talked about paradigm shifts earlier, what example comes close to this sort of a paradigm shift that we're talking about? Because what we are talking about over here is a very decentralized kind of a phenomenon, right? It's a reaction that's happening in large number of people across the country, across the world. And it is, it's also hypothesized that because of the COVID situation and the social isolation and social distancing measures, this has essentially created a lot of conducive factors for something like this to happen. It certainly is not, I mean, it can be pinpointed to the murder of George Floyd, but how it has unfolded on a large scale is a very complex phenomenon. What is going on in the world is a question that we find ourselves asking quite often nowadays. It's just so multidimensional.
Well, but let's just ask ourselves the question: is something like the change from the humor theory of disease to the germ theory of disease also multidimensional?
There is. I think in that example, we start looking at verifiable data and logical structures that are very hard to counter argue without having evidence, right? So when we move from the humor theory to germ theory, the chances of going back to humor theory are very little, because the momentum
that's true. But I'm just asking, like, how did I mean, I know that from the little I've read on the subject lately, that the authority structures that were continuing the humor theory of disease felt as though they were under attack, for instance, and also in order to pursue a more scientific approach to medicine, you had to, in some ways, break with the power and authority that existed. That it wasn't it was not a great way to build a career in medicine to decide that you wanted to look through a microscope. The germ theory of disease, and I'm not exactly sure when it arose and whether it arose before or after the scientification of medicine, the move away from medicine being considered some sort of folk art, and the professionalization of medicine. When did that come? Which came first? But there were forces, you know, political forces, educational forces, scientific, theoretical forces, that all came together to create conditions in which it was possible to change the emphasis and socially in medicine. And what I mean by that is, like, you know, rather than being a position of authority based on birth to some degree and land and resources, because what people would do is they would go and they'd get their degree in like 6 weeks and become doctors. And they would be able to do that from the most prominent and elite institutions in the country because they had the money to. It was just that simple. They didn't even have written exams. So that approach to medicine fell away for more than just logical reasons.
True. Yes, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's definitely multidimensional in that sense, because a lot of people are involved and a lot of people's minds change as the idea becomes more concrete or is talked about more or is presented in various ways that makes it accessible to more number of people. And there's a historicity to the whole process that that leads to that paradigm shift. Definitely.
I remember years ago I used to be interviewing a guy named Andrew Kleiman on the regular. He and I have had kind of a falling out, unfortunately, since then. But he would constantly talk about how the social sciences needed to be more like the actual sciences. Like no one would want to go to a doctor who behaved the way someone who was on the left in the social sciences behaved, right? And that's true today, but it was not true, you know, from the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, that people did go to doctors who behaved exactly, who just had dogmatic beliefs and would make the evidence fit the fact, you know, make the facts fit their theory you know, you had these manuals that were filled with 100 different remedies for a given disease, let's say tuberculosis, and none of them proved on examination later to work at all. But by listing all the different potential remedies in one book, you had it seemed authoritative.
That would not work for social science or human beings on large scale, because that's like suggesting something like out of a Brave New World or something, that where you create this very effective system to mass control or standardize.
He wasn't saying that we wanted to, that people should want from social scientists to have the kind of dictatorial authority that we worry about in something like A Brave New World, but rather that when you go to a social scientist and ask a question like, say, what is the cause of police violence against Black people in America, you should get an answer that has the rigor, the same kind of rigor and same sort of standards of evidence that you would expect from someone who is in the actual sciences, like, say, like a doctor would give you.
Good. That's a good line of thought. Yeah. I get it. Yeah.
But the problem there is that, you know, doctors have turned to evidence and empirical evidence and standards when it comes to treatments, you know, and turning to evidence and rigorous evaluation only slowly over the last 100 years. it's not as though that they've, you know, something about medicine makes it immune from all the problems that we think of as dogging the political realm.
Absolutely. So what kind of an equivalent do you see in the case of social sciences that would basically satisfy the conditions for what you just described? You know, like, how do you explain a social phenomenon? Is there a model, a concept, a principle, a theory that does that? And I'm suspecting that you will definitely say Karl Marx.
I want to, but I can't just say it, right?
Right. That's definitely a whole problem in itself.
Right. I want to say, well, we need this, but I don't know that it's the case that like, we have to think about what made the difference when it came to moving from the humor theory of disease to the germ theory of disease. It was not that that more people were able to be free to study medicine. It was not that equality was established, or that it is the case that there was more wealth probably being generated because it was happening around alongside of the Industrial Revolution. But I couldn't say that the real wealth in the world is what was decisive. I mean, obviously the innovations in production probably helped along the innovations in scientific research.
If we have to look at it in a very simple way for a moment, the difference between the humor theory and the germ theory is one of a concept and an idea, right? I mean, essentially it's an idea. And it's an idea that changes our way of looking at an objective reality. So it's a paradigm shift because it's a change in perspective that provides a view into a complex phenomenon that kind of enhances our understanding relative to where it was before that shift took place. And it could something equivalent be envisioned in social sciences could be one way of looking at it, perhaps.
Well, the thing about the – tell me if I'm wrong here, but my understanding of the move from the humor theory to the germ theory is it also had something to do with the move away from rationalist approaches to medicine towards empirical approaches to medicine.
Can you explain like what do you mean by that? Like,
well, rather than concocting a story or a logic that would explain the way what you're seeing in the body, kind of that's on the surface, instead there was an emphasis on doing more a closer analysis of empirical data and testing your story to see if it would hold up.
So it's a combination of empiricism and rationalization, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously the reason is never really gone from empirical, but you could – a purely rationalist approach could be one where, you know, you'd say, well, I've told a very coherent story and therefore because it coheres, it is the best story around.
That's silly though. I mean, that's
right. Right. But I mean, no one really does that because even then they were like, okay, well, look at the evidence we have. And they would have moments where they, with the naked eye, they would see things and they would, come up with a story. Like the reason the humor idea made some amount of sense was that, you know, when you have an infection, you do get swelling, for instance. So and maybe releasing swelling in certain circumstances, doing bloodletting or getting rid of the excess fluid does have a beneficial effect. You know, so regulating the levels of fluid is the whole idea of the humor theory in it. And it seemed to make some sort of empirical sense as well, but it wasn't based on the scientific method of
was not rigorous.
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 totally. So maybe one way of suggesting what's going on with social sciences or what's going on with human beings is that we have not appreciated some evidence, just like those people who are exsanguinating patients because they wanted to get rid of the faulty fluid from them. We're not considering that, well, there's some people who are dying because of that bleeding and that this was only sometimes effective, but most of the times it was not solving the problem. And what the exact causal relationship between getting rid of the fluids and treating the person, what exactly was that causal relationship was not properly framed in an empirical model. So if something like this is going on in the social sciences, we are essentially suggesting, I suppose, that there's something about ourselves that we don't know, something that we have not rigorously examined, something, some important piece of evidence that we have not contextualized and we have not updated our model of looking at this particular phenomenon of a social organism that we are on a global scale. So,
I mean, isn't the scientific approach to reality always the approach where the first assumption you make is there's something about ourselves or our situation or the world that we don't know?
Yeah.
I mean, you don't start the scientific inquiry from a state of knowledge.
No, not at all. You invoke that knowledge or you take it into consideration systematically to get closer to the unknown dimension. But then the moment you solve that, after you've celebrated, there is more questions and then the process continues endlessly, I think. I mean, that's a philosophical question that certainly ends with this infinite regression. And it's definitely going to be applicable even in the case of human beings. But what I suppose is the question of urgency over here is what is it that we need to do to save ourselves some time and needless effort to basically look at this in a different way. I don't have any answer. I mean, that would have been lovely if I did. But I think that's the direction that we need to look at when we talk about paradigm shifts in the context of social sciences.
I would say that that one thing that people need to do if they're going to succeed in changing the paradigm that sets up the relationships of society is think about their project as being aimed at not creating justice within this system, not overcoming their enemies, but rather fundamentally altering the structure of society. In other words, to as much as possible, not naturalizing the system as it is. And that also would mean, I think, not assuming that you already understand what you're facing. Like, because whenever you kind of, whatever you assume already, whatever is no longer, whatever you take to be not kind of questionable is, what is part, is almost always part of the current way that we understand things.
Right, right. Absolutely agree. What are the assumptions that we have about social sciences? In other words, how do we define our current paradigm before we start envisioning or imagining an alternative paradigm? So what are the assumptions and how do we at least begin to sketch an outline of the paradigm that we are living in right now? Because when I was recently watching this little video on, I think, the some philosophy channel on YouTube that was discussing Jean Baudrillard. Am I saying? Yeah. And posts, I butchered his name. Okay. So his views on postmodernism and this entire idea of simulation simulacrum is a good way of looking at this, it seems like, and we can throw in a little bit of Marshall McLuhan over there, and we can also bring in Hegel and phenomenology and look at what happens when we construct these things together and try to see if it works in you know, allowing us to define a paradigm.
Well, tell me what ideas from Baudrillard that you find useful when it comes to cutting through our assumptions.
And I might be totally, you know, messing this up because I think his ideas are complex.
You are. It's more, yeah. You know, Baudrillard is not as important as what your thoughts are here.
Okay. So I think what I found useful in his ideas is the suggestion of this persistent illusion, which is what Einstein called reality, that is perpetuated so ubiquitously in our world through media and through the mouthpieces of politicians and corporate leaders, is essentially a veil, a magic trick. And as long as we do not see that it's a magic trick, we are going to be mesmerized by the magical show. And that's kind of what I found is useful in his ideas as far as how we process our social and political reality through the lens of the world that we study and observe and become aware of through the information that we take in through the media and through our conversations with others. So it's pretty exciting when you think about it on a temporal level, because that it also suggests that shit is getting more and more complex as years go by, because we have more interconnected systems, we have more information flowing, people are doing data analytics and learning how to manipulate the views of other people, and so it's all getting more and more complex. And at the same time, our situation as human beings is that we are still pretty much trying to grapple with older paradigms that most of us are incapable of being aware of what's happening at the edge of the paradigm shifts that are happening, not because we are trying to make those paradigm shifts happen, but because there is an autonomous force that has already been unleashed because of technology and our complex psychosocial reality. It's just resulting in a differentiation, you know, like an emulsion breaking down, and we're seeing a phase transition over here where lots of people are going to be in a category of the masses, and there are going to be few people who are going to be in a position to call the shots or see certain aspects of reality on a higher level somewhere. And that power dynamic is something that people in an ordinary dimension are really, really frustrated by. And, you know, you can see that in quite a lot of these reactions.
Well, okay. So I want us to counter, I want to do two things. First, I want to counter Baudrillard with Zizek. Or your version of Baudrillard, anyway, with my version of Zizek.
Lovely. That makes me feel comfortable.
So, you said that Baudrillard points out the illusion of that the world really is that we're as long as we don't understand that it is that a magic trick is being performed, that there's a veil that we're being fooled by, we will continue to be mesmerized by a certain way of being in the world. And what I would say that what Zizek would add to that is that nonetheless, despite the fact that, yes, we are living in under illusion, yes, there is a veil of ignorance and or deception, more than ignorance, there's a veil that deceives us. Nonetheless, we cannot simply pull the veil aside. There's no way to strip the illusion aside and end up with some sort of concrete known reality that we can then usefully use, you know, that we can take up as our own and use to set up our relationships with each other in the world.
Okay. I see his objection, but then does he have,
we need a new veil.
We need a new veil.
We need a new trick. And we need to know that, and what, you know, the real kind of Hegelian turn here would be to know that it's ours, to know that we're pulling a trick on ourselves. But also to know that there's no other option for us, and that if we want to do something else, if we don't like this trick, we're going to have to come up with a new one. So that's the first thing I'd want to say. And then the second thing I'd want to say is that if you ask me what the primary – what one of the primary assumptions that people hold that I don't think necessarily is true is that there – that we are a world made up of peoples and ethnicities and cultures and nations. And I always go to this speech from the movie Network. Have you seen that movie?
Yes, long time ago. But yeah, there are certain scenes that I think I have sampled often.
I've got the text here in front of me, and it's the CEO of the media company and a bunch of other companies has pulled Howard Beale aside. So his name is Arthur Jensen. He's the CEO, and how he pulls Howard Beale, the news anchor who's gone crazy, aside, and he says,
"You have meddled with the primal forces of nature, Mr. Beale, and I won't have it. Is that clear? You think you merely stopped a business deal? That is not the case. The Arabs have taken billions of dollars out of this country, and now they must put it back. It is ebb and flow, tidal gravity. It is ecological balance. You are an old man who thinks in terms of nations and peoples. There are no nations. There are no peoples. There are no Russians. There are no Arabs. There are no third worlds. There is no West. There is only one holistic system of systems. worlds, one vast and immane, interwoven, interacting, multivariate, multinational dominion of dollars. Petrodollars, electrodollars, multidollars, Reichmarks, rins, rubles, pounds, and shekels. It is the international system of currency which determines the totality of life on this planet. That is the natural order of things today. That is the atomic and subatomic and galactic structure of things today. And you have meddled with the primal forces of nature. And you will atone. Am I getting through to you, Mr. Beale? You get up on your little 21-inch screen and howl about America and democracy. There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today. What do you think the Russians talk about in their councils of state? Karl Marx? They get out their linear programming charts, statistical decision theories, min-max solutions, and compute the price-cost probabilities of their transactions and investments, just like we do. We no longer live in a world of nations and ideologies, Mr. Beale. The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime. And our children will live, Mr. Beale, to see that perfect world in which there's no war or famine, oppression or brutality. One vast and ecumenical holding company for whom all men will work to serve a common profit, in which all men will hold a share of stock, all necessities provided, all anxieties tranquilized, all boredom amused. And I have chosen you, Mr. Beale, to preach this evangel.
Why me?
Because you're on television, dummy.
Thank you. But my point would be to everyone right now is that that's true, and there's two sides to it. It's not only that we're dominated by the financial and economic system of the world, but also that it's liberated us from some old relations based on religious deities or our sense of ourselves along old traditional cultural lines. That we are no longer really interacting with each other along those lines, and that we are but a hair's breadth away from overcoming those old divisions altogether, and that's a positive thing. That I mean, unfortunately, the way that what is mediating our relations is the economic system based on exploitation and money. But we have the capacity now as kind of one world people to maybe come together to overcome that system much more than we would have and much more than we can if we're divided up by religions and nationalities and ethnic groups and so forth.
Yes, yes. I definitely agree with your optimism on that for sure, because That's what makes this entire process worth it, right? Like just talking about this or thinking about it and, you know, imagining about how we can engineer or what part we can play in this. All of this worth it because we are making some progress as we inch forward.
Yeah, I hope so. I feel, though, that in this last month or so, or let's say 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks, that we have had, you know, we had the trauma of the COVID-19 internationally, and now we've had the trauma of the murder of George Floyd. But more than that, we've had the trauma of the riots and uprising that happened, and the sense that the U.S. state could end up being transformed so dramatically that it would actually, you know, for all intents and purposes, be collapsed. And what I mean by that is if the rioting had intensified and the National Guard had been unable to put it down, right, and had been unable to stop it. First of all, if the National Guard had had to stop it truly by the use of massive force, that in itself would have been an incident that would have been world historic and changed our society forever. If you have every state in the union and over 500 cities being marauded by thousands, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people, and the National Guard is brought in and it starts shooting into the crowds all across the country to try to stop the violence of the crowd. Which is directed at the state, right? Try to protect state institutions from the crowd, which was what was being threatened, right? If that had happened, well, I don't think there could have been anything but an escalation of more reaction from the public. I don't think that if that had happened, there would have been nothing for it but more from the public. The public would not have simply gone back to their homes and tried to pretend like nothing had happened. At least not right away. And then, so if that continued, if it escalated, then you're looking at something like the Arab Spring, where you have masses of people in the streets all the time protesting and trying to get rid of the government, directly attacking the government, and the military forces being brought in to try to stop them. And when they failed to stop them, the new authority that comes forward actually is the military and then the Muslims, brotherhood that you don't have a movement when it's directly attacking the state in that context that really is ready to pull a trick on itself and create the new illusion for a better society. You instead, have a moment of negation and then a falling away, kind of a regression into something that's just as bad, or I think in the case of the United States would be worse. So I feel like right now the protests that are going on are aimed primarily, maybe subconsciously, but their effects is primarily to try to create a way in which the system as it is can take up this massive amount of dissatisfaction and destructive energy and liquidate it, dissipate it, you know, reform it away, offer it whatever, you know, it needs for a time to bring things back to quiescence. So that's the project that's going on right now, is the project of bringing quiescence. And the truth is, I don't think there's anyone in the United States, hardly, who doesn't secretly want that return to quiet. And I think that's why that's actually just as much of what's powering the protest as any really radical impulse for change, is the idea of retreating and dissipating that uprising, which no one was quite prepared for, which was not actually willed, but kind of automatically brought into existence.
Right. I was speaking with Lorenzo Haggerty the other day, and he made this point that that this the people have had a lot of time to think about a lot of things in ways that they haven't before, not being distracted by a 9-to-5 job and a normal economy going on outside, has made us really question a lot of things on an individual level. And that also is probably a factor that facilitated this autonomous
emergence. I don't feel that. Okay. As an individual, I'm not saying it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying my circumstances are such that, first of all, I was already quarantined before the quarantine came along.
Right.
I work from home. And secondly, I do is consider these kinds of things, considering how much time I spend on it or how much time I should be spending on it. I'm actually, I should be a lot better than I am, but the truth is, like, I don't nothing for me changed under the quarantine except the concerns about COVID and the concerns and what the literal concerns were. But I can imagine that some people were brought out of their routine by the COVID and were given a chance to, like, if you took everyone on a spiritual retreat for 3 months, is kind of what he's saying, is that, and then they have to face themselves at the end of it, is that
kind of, yeah, I think that would be a good approximation.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I think also there was a sense of, you know, a lot of people don't have jobs to go back to or are unsure about what their future is going to be. And they're out of work, so they're not required to be anywhere. So it's easier than ever to go out and protest because your other option is to stay at home and do nothing.
I mean, I didn't mean to – like, I think that would be putting it like a little too in a straightforward fashion. But what I feel the legitimacy in that connection between the pandemic and what it has done to us socially is that it has for a moment exposed the trick of that we were mesmerized with or involved with, conditioned with, as we went about our normal days and nights consuming and, you know, doing our things and that perturbation in that particular normalcy definitely has some kind of a collective effect. I mean, we probably won't be able to pinpoint it on an individual level. I mean, I would agree with you in a similar way that I don't find major things in my individual mindset having been changed because of being extracted from the routine of my own life. But I do feel that my way of perceiving the world have dramatically changed because of the pandemic and what it has done in terms of how is it going to affect me as my worldviews, you know, change and evolve with time is probably something that everyone is experiencing in their own ways. I mean, nobody is probably in a position to say that, I don't feel anything different because of the pandemic. And so even though we can't pinpoint it on an individual level, the collective emergent behavior that we're seeing coming out of this is definitely noteworthy or, you know, needs to be considered. I think what he was suggesting is that he in fact said that I find it hard to imagine if this would have happened on the same scale if it wasn't in the pandemic
That's absolutely, I agree with that 100%.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that I can't imagine, I have a difficulty imagining myself as someone who wasn't aware that the world was having real troubles before the pandemic.
I would say I would count myself in that too, even though the relative difference is huge. I don't think it affects us the same way.
Right. But I'm not sure if that's I can't tell one way or the other whether that's that story of the person who was working the regular job and thought everything was going along just fine and then was put into a quarantine and suddenly had 2 months to spend with their family and thinking and reading and going into it and coming out going, oh, I'm really dissatisfied now, even though I was perfectly content before. I would imagine that people, you know, people were feeling dissatisfaction before and that just intensified what was already there. But that's my imagining. But the other thing I want to point out is that more than the pandemic, the riots in the streets, the massive amounts of unrest, the targeting of governmental authority, and the fact that it was able to that was able to be effective, the fact that the president of the United States was hiding in a bunker because of his protesters at the gates of the White House, all of that really did a number on undermining a major myth or magic trick that goes on in society all the time, which is that the state and the authority that exists is very, very, very powerful and can't be overturned. That is not the case. Because the state ultimately is us, that when we go after the state, like if the military were to be sent in to deal with the with the U.S. public, well, if the military, if the troops obeyed orders, which they likely would not in all cases, right? But if they did, then what would be left of the U.S. state would be a fraction of what it had been. It would be attacking itself to save itself. And so the authority of the United States as a nation in the world would be tiny in comparison to what it was before. And so would the economic abilities of that state. It would just be a shambles after that. And by its own, so it would have turned on itself and destroyed itself, basically.
Is that a symptom of the polarization that is very evident in the U.S.? There's definitely a polarization of political loyalties and worldviews, it seems like. And do you think that's like related to what you're just describing?
Well, yeah, I do think – I think that if it were willing to do that, it would have to be based on polarization and a sense of some fraction of the U.S. public siding with the state authority as it is enough to warrant that. Because if you really are just turning against like let's say 90% of your own public who is willing to – who's and of the 90% that's turned against you – 20% is willing to fight in the streets and you're willing to use troops to come in and somehow they're miraculously they're part of that 10% that's still on your side. I just wouldn't imagine that the troops would be on your side if you, all you had was 10% or, you know, some small sliver of the population that still supported you. If you really were, there was a uniform, a feeling of a need for overthrow, that the only way a state could really hold on to power was to use so much destructive force that it would take itself out with it. So the reality is that the state can't use violence as thoroughly as it pretends to. It really relies on our acceptance of it.
Right. One thought that occurred while you were describing this. So is what's going on in the U.S. different from any other uprising anywhere else in the world in history?
I don't know. I'm sure it is different. I mean, one thing is it was much, if you want to compare it to the Arab Spring, it was stopped and it was, it never quite had the potential that the uprising in Egypt and Tunisia had. And for a number of reasons, I mean, one of the reasons was that it wasn't aimed at the state from the perspective of everyone in the population. It was narrowed down to a particular complaint of a sector of the population that everyone was on board with. But when I forget the guy's name in Tunisia, but there was the guy who set himself afire in Tunisia because his food cart license and food cart itself, I think, was taken away from him. And it was his only way of making a living. And so he went to
the police station and set himself on fire. And he didn't die right away, but he died over, you know, over the weeks that came later. And, that act was an act of kind of primal rejection of the authority and a primal kind of scream against society. And it wasn't being done in the name of one religious group in a society that was dominated by another religious group. It wasn't being done, by, you know, black people only or Native American people only, or it was being done in the name of the Tunisian, of a regular Tunisian person who represented Tunisian people who were mostly impoverished, right? And, I don't know what his ethnicity is or whether he, you know, and it didn't matter. And I'm not saying that that made him more ethical. It just made him, it was just a different moment, politically and historically. And so this had the potential to become that, despite the, George Floyd had the potential to be a representative of every American.
Oppressed person.
Yeah. Every American, really, that wasn't part of the government. Every citizen of the United States who wasn't part of the government.
But also, I think he hasn't quite become that.
To the extent that he did become that, he became a major threat. His death became a major threat to the state. But I think there's a big attempt right now to walk back that sort of reaction because no one's prepared for it. We don't know where we would go. We don't have a new trick.